All right, we continue our study of the book of Exodus. We're going to be in chapters 26 and 27 today. And, you know, this is a lot of detail about how the tabernacle is to be constructed. Most of the time, people kind of just skim this text and move on. And to be honest with you, we're not going to look at it in great detail when it comes to all the nooks and crannies, you know, where those loops are, how those loops are made, what metal they're made out of, you know, what they join together, all those sort of things. You know, go ahead and read it. I encourage you to read it. I've actually seen a lot of commentators make a lot of analogies and allegorical type assertions from, you know, some of the things that are here. All well and good, no problem with that. But I think it's going to serve us better if we just look at some of the theological things that the tabernacle actually present to us. And here's the reason why. Let's say, for instance, you're an Israelite. And, you know, you've just had the experience at Mount Sinai, okay, and you've seen the structure that happened there. We're going to compare the structure of Mount Sinai today with the structure of the tabernacle. But you've seen that, and, you know, you're really excited and obviously fearful at the same time that God is back, okay? He is creating a sacred space so that we can dwell together again. You know, he's been gone. You know, we haven't seen him. And all of a sudden he's back. And so there's, even though it's been generations and generations and generations, the oral traditions and, you know, just the knowledge of what it was like at Eden would thrill the heart of any Hebrew person who heard the recount of the story of the days when, you know, God and Adam and Eve walked together in the cool of the garden. And all of a sudden now they're beginning to see this sacred space that mirrors that. Okay. And I'm going to assert to you that this is a time of great joy, at least. You know, if it, just like if today, you know, you saw Christ coming back in the clouds, I mean, think about the joy that that's going to be. Well, this is almost that same thing, okay? And so we're going to look at some of those theological things today. So that's where we're going. And, you know, we studied chapter 25 last week. We've dealt now with the Ark of the Covenant, the Table of Showbread, the menorah, some of the furniture that's inside of the tabernacle. We talked about, you know, what they represent and how they were used, all those sorts of things. You know, we're not gonna recount that again. If you want to go back and listen to it, it was last week's podcast. But the point is that, you know, as we study this in detail, I think it's extremely important to know how the people felt and what they were seeing, as opposed to something that for a 21st century American is extremely foreign in thought and structure. Not so to them. Again, we talked last week about even though God called Moses up and said, now I want you to manufacture these things, build these things to these exact specifications, the Bible nowhere says they're unique, and they're not. You know, the tabernacle is not a unique thing. You can find the structure of the tabernacle in many other dwelling places of gods in the ancient Near East. You definitely can find an ark, okay, especially in Egypt. So these things aren't unique. They're obviously sacred in the way that they're built and the way that they're used. Although, again, the people are automatically going to know, well, I know what's going to end up in the ark and I know where it's going to end up being. They would have already known those things because they've seen it before. You know, these suzerain vassal treaties that take place, you know, and the treaties written on something, you know, stone, cuneiform, something, and, you know, it's put in an ark and it's put underneath the throne of the suzerain that is mastering the treaty, you know. So they get all this, you know, they see it, they get all this, but there's something deeper, you know, something more special. And so, you know, last week in Exodus 25:8, we read this: let them make me a sanctuary that I may dwell in their midst. Okay? And that's the point. God is coming to dwell. He's coming to tabernacle with them. He's coming to dwell. And, you know, there's plenty of scholars that have noticed that, you know, this is a key verse, and that we should understand that, you know, this Hebrew word Shekinah is the verb form of the word tabernacle, mishkan, tabernacle. This language that verse 8 in chapter 25 lays out is the fact that God is coming back to dwell with us. And we've already discussed the fact that the Ten Commandments are evangelistic in nature. You know, they're not a set of do's and don'ts. They're evangelistic. You live by these things, it sets you apart. And when the pagan, profane people, the common people, look over the fence and they look at you and they'll say, you know, I wish my marriage looked like that. I wish my garden grew like that. I wish my family acted like that, and I wish my God lived in my presence like that. Our gods live up on the mountain. They never come down. You know, they don't want to have anything to do with us unless they want something. But their God lives in their midst, and that's a big part about what's going on here. They're going to look over the fence and say, oh my goodness, you know, their God's living amongst them. Their God is dwelling with them. And so that's the big deal. And the big picture ideas that go with the tabernacle that we're going to drill down into today is this cosmic garden motif. You know, gods live on mountains. That's why people didn't climb mountains. Nobody in the ancient Near East climbed mountains because gods live up there. I'm not going up there. And gods also lived in the best places. They lived in gardens that were well-watered, that grew lots of food. You know, there wasn't any need or want there. And so, you know, we see too that God, El Shaddai, is the God of the mountain. Okay? And so we've already met him. He's on Mount Sinai. He's the God of the mountain. And he's also a god of a garden. Ezekiel calls Eden a mountain. But, you know, as we looked at Eden in Exodus 1 and 2, we see plainly that it's a garden. It's a well-watered garden, as a matter of fact, how it's described. That's where God would live. You know, he's the god of a garden. He's the god of a mountain. Okay? And so here we are. We've got this tabernacle that's being built, and some of the things about this tabernacle would automatically remind us that's kind of where we're going. As we move into the tabernacle, we get the feeling, the flavor that we're going to a mountain place that's a garden, and we're going into the throne room of God. In order to get us kicked off here, I'm not going to read all these details. But I am going to read the first. Let's see. Let me read the first four verses of Exodus 26 to kind of get us kicked off here. It says this: "Moreover, you shall make the tabernacle with 10 curtains of fine twine linen and blue and purple and scarlet yarns. You shall make them with cherubim skillfully worked into them. The length of each curtain shall be 28 cubits, the breadth of each curtain 4 cubits, and the curtains shall be the same size. 5 curtains shall be coupled to one another, and the other 5 curtains shall be coupled to one another. And you shall make loops of blue on the edge of the outermost curtain in the first set. Likewise, you shall make loops on the edge of the outermost curtain in the second set." So praise God for His word, but you can see that this is the reason why we're not going to just drill down and read word for word these two chapters, because these are very detailed, specific instructions out as to how the whole tabernacle is basically held together. And again, you know, if you wanted to spend 10 weeks in these two chapters trying to allegorize everything, you could certainly do it. But I think it's more important for us to understand the hearts of the people and what's going on here. Because they're being asked to contribute and construct this very expensive project. And the first thing I want you to see from what we read, again, that we've already talked about, but again, just to remind you, the curtains were made out of fine twined linen, blue and purple and scarlet yarns. Those were the most expensive of all, okay? And so, you know, as we come into the tabernacle, again, we've talked about this already, you know, we come in and we've experienced 3 different metals. The first is bronze. It's the cheapest of the 3 metals, and that's what we're introduced to as we come into the court. And then we move closer in and, you know, we see silver, and then we move closer yet, and we see gold, and then we move all the way into the most holy place, and we see solid gold, not just wood overlaid with gold, but solid gold. And so, you know, the closer you get to God, the more precious the metal. And obviously, as you come into the tabernacle, all of the curtains, everything that you see, are the best and the most precious of the things that they have. And then, you know, we see that there's cherubim skillfully weaved into the fabric. So, and if you look at the veil of the holy place, you'll see that, you know, it has cherubim inside. They're all over the place, you know. So, and cherubim. There we go. Yeah, Sheila's giving it the Vanna White tour of the tabernacle here. So cherubim are throne guardians, okay? And you know, there's the word cherubim and there's the word seraphim, okay, in Scripture, both talking about the exact same creature, okay? Depends on whether you're talking about it from a Babylonian standpoint or an Egyptian standpoint, as to which word you use, but they're the only members of the spiritual family of God, His divine counsel, that have wings, that are said to have wings, and their job is to guard the throne room of God against defilement. Okay, so you always see cherubim when you come into the throne room of God, whether you do it in Isaiah chapter 6, you know, with Isaiah, or anywhere, you're going to come across these creatures, and so they're woven in to the fabric. And so again, when the people would come in, they would, you know, "I'm coming into the throne room of God. I'm coming into the mountain of God, into this garden area where the cherubim are making sure that God doesn't get defiled in any way, shape, or form. And so, you know, this is what the hearts of the people would have seen and known and understood. They would have got this. They just would have. We look at the tabernacle and we think, oh, well, you know, it's a church building in a tent somehow. Well, no, you know, it's not. The motif is a garden motif. The motif is a throne room motif. It's a mountain motif. We are going to feel and experience those real things as a Hebrew as we walk into this place. All right. So, seeing and recognizing and knowing that, then let's take a look at some of the theological aspects of you know what we're dealing with here, because as we do, I think we'll grow to appreciate a little bit more what the hearts of the people were feeling, and I think that's more important than talking about why they use gold rings on the curtains as opposed to silver and those kinds of things. I mean, it's interesting enough, but I would rather kind of spend our time together this way. Now, there's a scholar whose name is Rodriguez that has written some of the most peer-reviewed and accepted articles on both the tabernacle and the sacrificial system than anybody else in modern scholarship. And so I'm going to just read for you just a couple of snippets from a white paper that he wrote entitled Sanctuary Theology in the Book of Exodus. And he says this, various investigators have noticed a parallel between God's appearance on the mountain, Mount Sinai, and God's manifestation in the sanctuary, and obviously the tabernacle. And so, you know, what he's saying in that sentence is, hey, you know, there seems to be a relationship between the way the events unfolded at Sinai and how it was talked about and how the tabernacle is being constructed. Okay, he's saying that, you know, many scholars, including him, notice that these two things mirror each other. So, and he goes on to say this, with respect to the experience at Sinai, as soon as the people arrived there, the Lord commanded them to get ready for the meeting with him. The Israelites were to consecrate themselves and to wash their garments. That's Exodus 19:10. And on the third day, Moses was to bring them out of the camp to meet God. That's verse 17. The people prepared themselves for the appointment, and on the morning of the third day, Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. You know, that's Exodus 19:16-18. Although Yahweh and his people were to meet, the people themselves actually were not to have access to the mountain. Says this, and you shall set bounds for the people round about, saying, take heed that you do not go up into the mountain or touch the border of it. So Sinai became holy because it held God's presence, and it was fenced in so to avoid the violation of its sanctity by the Israelites. And so, you know, now we start looking at the tabernacle and we see, well, it has those sacred zones just like Mount Sinai did. You know, there were certain places that only some people could go. Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 elders could go a little bit further than all the rest of the clan. They had to stay behind. And they couldn't go past this fence or this boundary that was set up, lest they would die. None of the animals could go past that, lest they would die. But, you know, Moses and the gang and the 70 elders, and we've already dealt with that in chapter 19, where, you know, they went up for the first time being invited into God's house, as opposed to God coming to see them via the angel of the Lord, Jesus, the pre-incarnate God-man who walked, you know, all through the Old Testament. And we saw that they came up for the very first time, invited into God's house, and they ate a meal there. Okay. And, you know, there was human flourishing going on there. Bless you. And so, but, you know, Sinai and the tabernacle, you know, they're beginning, you know, as you look at it, they're mirroring each other. It goes on to say an altar was also built at the foot of the mountain, Exodus 24:4, to which only certain young men selected by Moses and from among the people could go to offer sacrifices. Access to the mountain itself was limited to Moses, Aaron, Nadab, Abihu, and 70 elders of Israel, who could go up a certain distance on the mountain only after the covenant had been ratified. There they also worship the Lord afar off and participate in the covenant meal. While there, they saw God, or perhaps more particularly, the place where the Lord was standing. Remember, we discussed that, you know, where, you know, it actually talked about, you know, you saw God's feet. Because of his feet that's mentioned, he says, and Moses alone could ascend all the way up the mountain near to Yahweh, where the glory of Yahweh was manifested in a very special way. He went up there to get the tablets of stone containing God's law. So, you know, he goes on and on and on, but, and, you know, I'm not going to just sit here and read to you, but the point, what he's actually making is that when they're looking at the tabernacle, they're remembering Sinai. Okay, they know what happened there, and they know that there are degrees of sacred space, and the fact that this is different. It's the same, and it's different than Eden. Okay, and that's where we're going to go next. I think that's, you know, a part of this whole experience, this whole idea of sacred space, that's very important, both to them and to us. And again, most of the time, you know, 21st century Americans think the sacrificial system was set up to atone for sin, and it was not at all. You know, there was no sacrifice for the sin of murder. You know, you couldn't sacrifice and get out of murder. No, you were going to be killed. That's all there was to it. You couldn't sacrifice because you told a lie and be absolved of that. There's no such thing as that. Never. You know, you were guilty. That's all there was to it. And you were going to be punished. There was no sacrifice to get out of sin. The sacrifices, this blood that's, you know, we talked about this, the blood that's sprinkled in the Holy of Holies, you know, on the horns of the mercy seat, the atonement seat, really, it's to wash away the defilement that you cause. It's to keep the place sacred so that God can continue to dwell there. And that's the point. God's not cleaning you up. He's keeping a space that's clean so that you and Him can dwell together. That's the point. And so that's what's going on here. And so this is that sacred space. And this is going to remind them of Eden, no question. But it's different. At the same time, it's different than Eden. But one of the interesting things, you know, most scholars will point out that that there's parallels between the tabernacle instructions that when you read these tabernacle instructions, and these instructions go from, basically, let's say they're going to start in 25:8, you're going to build me a tabernacle, and they go all the way to chapter 31. And in that whole section, God says seven times, like to Moses, he says in Exodus 25:1, 30:11, 30:17, and 22:34, 31:1, and 31:12, in those places, he says seven times, He said, and Yahweh said to Moses. So these are seven speeches that God told Moses in order for him to construct the tabernacle correctly. Okay, so in other words, seven times he says, this is what I want you to do, Moses, and Moses went and did it seven times. And the interesting thing about what happened at the very end when Moses surveyed the tabernacle that had been built, he looked at it, he said, ah, it's done. And then he blessed the people, Moses did. Okay? Now, let's think back to Genesis 1 and 2, the creation story. Okay? How many times did God speak a word? Seven times. Okay? And, you know, the interesting thing is you can even move into the book of Leviticus as God sets up the sacrificial system that keeps the sacred space clean. How many times did he instruct the people as to how to do the sacrifices? Well, you guessed it, seven times. Okay, so these seven words. Seven words created the tabernacle. Seven words created the sacrificial system. Seven words created the cosmos. And so, you know, they're looking at these things and they're saying, wait a minute, you know, this is the people are going to be thinking about Mount Sinai, and at the same time, they're going to be thinking about Eden. They're going to be thinking about the creation story. As they build this tabernacle, they're going to say, ah, this is exactly what we've experienced. And in that, they're going to get extremely, extremely excited. There's another scholar. His name is Gorman, and he wrote an excellent paper that's arguing and relating the seven speeches by Yahweh in Exodus 25 to 31, corresponding them to the seven speeches of creation in Genesis 1:1 through 2:4. Okay, so that's where you find those seven speeches in Genesis. And to be honest with you, he tries to match them exactly, and I don't know whether they match exactly. But the point is, the main thing is, it's the first speech, the second speech, and the last speech of the book of Leviticus and Exodus and the tabernacle construction and Genesis 1 and 2. They all do very similar things. The first speech kicks everything off. The second speech gives a summarization of everything that's happening. And then the last speech is the speech about the Sabbath and the blessing of the people. Okay? And that's just how they all link together. And that's the reason why, you know, the Hebrews would have said, oh, you know, we know it. We see what's going on. And so, you know, I would encourage you to read those simultaneously and for yourself, see, you know, what scholars have seen for years and years, that these things are linked and God is doing exactly the same thing that he did, you know, from day one. You know, as we open up the first page of the Bible, God doesn't change. He's doing these patterns over and over and over again, because there's this whole idea of 6 days plus a seventh day. Okay? According to Exodus 24:15 through 17, Moses climbed Mount Sinai to receive instructions for the building of the sanctuary. He waited for 6 days. Okay? And on the seventh day, the Lord spoke to him out of the cloud. Okay? So there's, you know, it's just this pattern over and over and over again. The sequence of 6 days and the seventh day is the exact same sequence that we find in Genesis. It's actually the same sequence that we find in Leviticus. And then, you know, the seven divine speeches. God gave Moses instructions concerning the building of the sanctuary through seven speeches, introduced by the phrase, the Lord said to Moses, and in those passages I rattled off to you. And then, you know, the seventh speech brings the instructions for the building of the sanctuary to a close with a call to keep the Sabbath. That's Exodus 31:13 and 17. And in the creation narrative in Genesis, God spoke during 7 days and rested on the seventh day. And it seems, he says, Gorman says, it seems that it is the pattern that's being followed in the building of the tabernacle hill here. And so, you know, they talk about these linguistic parallels, you know, as these speeches are being done, you know, they're parallel to each other. He goes on and says, Genesis states that the heavens and the earth were finished. After building the sanctuary, it stated that all the work of the tabernacle and the tent of meeting was finished. The same verb is used, asah. And, you know, they relate to each other. So, you know, the other thing too is God separated everything in the creation story. He separated the day from the night. You know, he separated the landmass from the water. He separated, you know, the water above the heavens, the firmament, from that below. There was separation, the separation speech. Every time that he created something, it was to separate something. And then you go to the manufacture of the tabernacle, and all these curtains, and what are they used for? To separate things. Okay? And so, you know, the cosmos is ordered, the tabernacle is ordered, and they're ordered exactly the same way. You know, it's all about the presence of the Spirit of God. And this is interesting. He points this out. The Spirit of God is mentioned in both the creation narrative and the construction of the tabernacle. And so the interesting thing here about the Spirit of God is it's mentioned first in Genesis 1:1. The Spirit of God was hovering above all things. It's not mentioned again, the Spirit of God is not mentioned again until the completion of the tabernacle, where it's Exodus 31:3, the Spirit of God is hovering over it. Okay? So, you know, there you have it. I mean, you know, those are the linguistic parallels. Those are the things that the people are seeing and experiencing. And to be honest with you, you know, I think that's the reason why. That's the reason why it's so exciting. And that's the reason why we should be so excited about it, because this is God saying, okay, at the Tower of Babel, I divorced all humanity, spread them out in 70 different nations, and assigned 70 different divine council members, gods, over top of them. And they are not my people, and I am not their God, and I have nothing to do with them. Nothing. And then he resurrected Abraham, okay? And he formed his own nation. And now he's the God only of that nation, no other people on earth, only of that nation. And now all of a sudden, finally, they see that he's about to tabernacle with them again. Through all that, you know, Eden's gone by that time. Eden's done. It's history. And so this is a very exciting time. This is a time where Abraham's descendants are saying, oh, finally, God is back. He's back. Now, what's the difference, though? Now, those are the similarities, but what's the difference between the tabernacle and Eden? There's one glaring difference. There was no such thing as a sacrificial system in Eden. You know, there was no need to clean and make sacred space. It was always sacred space until the fall. Okay, there was, you know, when Adam and Eve walked and they walked with God, they just strolled in the garden without having to worry about separations of anything, you know, without having to do any kind of sacrificial work so that you could keep the space clean. But now it has to be done. And so, you know, what are we thrilled about today as we sit here? Well, you know, the finished work on the cross, Jesus work on the cross, his death, burial, resurrection, and ascension, and reign has made us clean, no longer needing, you know, this ceremonial ritualistic cleansing anymore, you know. And so that's what we celebrate, you know, because actually, even though, you know, we're not in Eden, we're in the world, we're still not in need of a sacrificial system anymore. You know, we're already the priesthood of believers. You know, we've been cleansed, you know, by the blood of Christ, which was a one-time thing. And so, you know, that's what we joy in today. So as we look at the tabernacle and what's progressing with the people there, you know, we get a sense of their joy as we remember our own salvation and remember the day that, you know, we became a citizen of this kingdom, that God came to us and dwelled inside of us, tabernacles inside of us. That relationship is much more like Adam and Eve's original relationship than it is the tabernacle. It's even better than the tabernacle. Okay, so, you know, that's it. Through all of that detail, you know, I really wanted you to see and know and understand, you know, everything here that's going on, in not in the detail of how the curtains were hung, but in the detail of how the people's hearts would have felt and rejoiced and would have recognized what was happening. Okay, so any questions about that?
Well, you said like the tabernacle is not unique, like
no,
those things. So in the world at that time, what would there have been similar setups for different gods?
Yeah, Sheila, actually, let Sheila put the pictures up that she had. Because, you know, it's easy to find the mapped architecture of, you know, similar, basically dwelling places of gods. And they're exactly the same as the tabernacle.
So, like, Solomon's temple would have been similar.
Oh, it would, yeah, it was exactly, yeah, okay. Very similar. But not just Solomon's. You can go to Egypt. You can go to some of the Ugaritic texts. In the Mesopotamian plain,
they got the idea from the Garden of Eden, the original.
Well, not only that, but they are hobnobbing with the other gods, and the other gods are telling them the exact same patterns.
Yeah,
you know, and you know, why wouldn't you see similarity? Because they came from the same place that this particular blueprint came from.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
See. Blow it up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
There you go. Okay, so you have the tabernacle, and then you have later Solomon's temple.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So you basically have the same exact, you know, thing going on there, mm-hmm. right? Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, okay. Take it this way. No balcony board.
No.
Okay. All right. So now you have just another vision here. Here's the tabernacle. Okay. And then the temple, and you see the similar courtyard, the outer sanctum, the Holy of Holies, the courtyard, the Holy Tent, the Holy of Holies. But this up here is Ramesses, the Pharaoh's camp.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And the Pharaoh's camp is exactly the same. You have a courtyard that enters into this holy place, and then you have the holiest place, his.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So he had the same setup, and it's actually considered a war camp.
Mm-hmm.
Here is,
oh, I remember you showing us that. Okay. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Here is the image that they, you know, took from the hieroglyphics to prove that. So the tabernacle going through the wilderness was a war camp, basically, where the God was in their presence, and this is exactly the way the Egyptians saw their temples, their places. So, like Mike said, the divine, you know, they were all together at the divine council, right? This is the way heaven is set up. This is the way God's divine council room is set up, because he said to Moses, come up here on the mountain, and, you know, and I'm going to show you what it looks like up here. You're going to make a replica of where I'm at up here. So all those little G gods had been in the divine council, had seen the original, so they went out into their nations and duplicated. So that's why you have the duplicates in all these other cultures.
Right. And so look at Ramses there. Now you see in the holy place, there's priests, okay?
Yeah.
Then you see two cherubim,
yeah.
Okay? And then you see that name ring right there, the name ring that the cherubim are, you know, holding up.
Yeah.
That's Pharaoh's name, okay? In hieroglyphics, anytime you see that oblong ring, that's Pharaoh's, that's not always Pharaoh's name, but it's a Pharaoh's name. It's a proper name inside of a name ring. There's no such thing in hieroglyphics as someone's name that doesn't reside in that ring. And so you can see that's Pharaoh. So it's Pharaoh in that name ring, the cherubim, and then the priests, and then all the other people out in the outer court, the other warriors out in the outer court. It's exactly the same thing, precisely the same thing.
Pharaoh declared himself God.
Yeah.
Okay, you got to remember that.
Years and years and years before the tabernacle design.
Okay. The throne room in heaven, was it the exact same size as the tabernacle in the desert?
Oh, I don't know about the same size, but it was the same design.
So that's in the desert, it was probably a smaller form.
I would think
God's throne room. Would
yeah, I would agree. I mean, you know, the divine council members are there, and there's and then there's thousands of worshipers, angels there. Mm-hmm. It sounds like a big place to me.
Yeah,
but
I was fine.
Yes.
I can't see how God could fit in the most holy place.
Right. Well, he didn't. You're right. And he really did fit in the most holy place. You're right.
Basically. Okay. Looking at nighttime version, daytime version. Okay. Basically, it was his Shekinah glory. His Shekinah glory. His presence.
God was
hovering.
Yeah.
The hovering.
Okay.
Just like
but everyone could see that.
Right.
Even outside of Israelites, which is kind of cool.
This is why Rahab said the Jericho people were trembling in fear. Mm-hmm. This is what they saw coming at them. You tremble.
Yeah.
Well, and you know the point too, even in the text, the lid of the ark is God's footstool. I mean, it's where his feet are resting. But God, you know, the whole idea of God meets the whole expanse. I mean, it's only his feet that are touching touching the tabernacle. So. All right, well, we'll continue to talk, but there I'm going to just stop the podcast. And next week, we're going to get into the priestly garments. Now, that is an extremely interesting story.
And I've got some questions on that.
Yeah, okay, very good. And there's some questions. Yeah, so,
that's like space alien stuff.
Yes, it is. That's right. And what are they doing? That's the... What is the priest actually doing as he's dressing? That it's fascinating. It's a fascinating story.
Because you ask a Baptist preacher and he runs from you like you're out of your mind.
Oh yeah.
Where do you get your information on that?
Okay. Well, let me go ahead and end the podcast. And so we'll see you next week and we'll talk about the priestly garments.
Okay.